and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped, and the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for 2 flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, those latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed. And they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing 2 Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Bnei Brak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, which led to the killing of 5 Israelis and the perpetrator Dia Hamashi from Yabet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the 2 youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation, dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by three lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat and Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there, so their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics, because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, but this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues, but people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In his 50-minute televised address on Thursday, Pakistan's embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan came up with serious allegations against the U.S.
They say they're angry with Pakistan. They make this excuse. They say they will forgive Pakistan if Imran Khan loses in the no-trust move. But if the move fails, Pakistan will have to go through a difficult time.
The so-called threat letter was based on the conversation between the Pakistani ambassador in Washington and the U.S. officials. According to the government, U.S. officials were unhappy with Pakistan over its neutral stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The letter then goes on to say that Pakistan would be isolated if the vote of no confidence against Imran Khan failed. This has led the government to conclude that the no-trust move of opposition has the backing of the U.S. Pakistan has summoned a senior diplomat in Islamabad and lodged a formal protest over the controversy.
It's a serious thing, very serious, that pertains to Pakistan's national security. And the onus lies on the Prime Minister Imran Khan that he should bring forth, tell the nation, tell the stakeholders that what is the conspiracy.
Opposition parties have strongly rejected allegations that the U.S. was behind their no-confidence motion. The government also says it has uncovered a plot to assassinate Prime Minister Khan. All this is happening just ahead of the crucial vote of no confidence against the Prime Minister on Sunday.
Prime Minister Khan is linking the vote of no confidence with a foreign conspiracy. Despite losing a majority in the parliament, the embattled Prime Minister insists he would not step down. This means the political battle would go all down to the wire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far, and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination. Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish Border Guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students. Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off. and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
It is something Iran has accused the U.S. of before, yet the U.S. has failed in that regard, failing in making political decisions, which Iran has said has led to a halt in the Vienna talks. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the Iranian accusations against the U.S., one in which Iran has said that the U.S. is trying to hold the remaining issues hostage to its internal affairs. What those internal affairs are and the chances of the JCPOA revival talks' success are other issues we will look at in this edition of The Spotlight. To get the latest, first we're going to cross on over to Vienna and talk to our correspondent, Homolesky. Homolesky, at this point we know that Iran is very critical of the U.S., not that it has not been before, but at this stage it is pretty important. Tell us why.
Yeah, so let's look at the comments that have been made by Iranian top Iranian officials, the foreign minister himself, the foreign ministry spokesman, saying that when very recently Enrique Mora, the EU coordinator, came to Iran, the Iranians gave him the message or the response or the proposals on how to resolve the remaining issues. The red lines were clear. How far Iran was willing to go was clear. Now it's the U.S. that has to respond, and it has not done so. Here in Vienna, there were reports, of course, that the media tent outside the Coburg Palais Hotel is being dismantled. And in response to media reports about speculations as to what this means for the fate of the negotiations, the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, tweeted, saying that because everything basically has already been written, the texts are all ready, and there are just these remaining issues between the Iranians and the Americans, once and if these issues are resolved, there'll only be a requirement for the participants to have a very short, in his words, meeting to announce formally the decision that they want to revive the JCPOA. But what Iran is asking now is the U.S. really willing to do that? Does it want the JCPOA to be revived? Because if it does, it has to adopt a realistic approach. It has to announce the political decision. What are the remaining issues from various reports we're hearing? It includes the scope of sanctions, the extent of sanctions that need to be rolled back, including those affecting Iran's IRGC, as well as guarantees that any future U.S. president would not withdraw from the JCPOA. So what we're seeing now in terms of how analysts, commentators are viewing the situation, they're saying this is the Biden administration that came into the White House with the campaign promise to undo what the Trump administration did when it came to the JCPOA. Mr. Biden was vehemently against the move by President Trump to withdraw from the JCPOA, but now they say he's effectively exploiting that decision and increasing pressure on Iran, especially since the U.S. also very recently introduced new sanctions on individuals and companies in Iran. Is there a will on the American side, Iran is asking, to make this happen? Because if they do resolve these very few issues that all participants believe can be resolved, then it is still realistic to assume that the JCPOA can come back to life.
Thank you very much for that. Homa Lesnik there from Vienna. We do appreciate it. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have political analyst Saeed Mostafa Khoshesh, who joins us from Tehran. Also joining us, writer and political analyst John White, who joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Saeed Mostafa Khoshesh. Iran has made some statements, and let's look at one of them, if you can break it down for us as to what it means. Khatibzadeh, the Iranian foreign ministry spokesperson, saying all of us should not forget that what we are facing today is not an administration that wants to perform its duties, but rather one that seeks to exploit legal means in order not to honor its obligations. What is he saying there?
Well, thanks for having me. If you just take a look at what the Biden administration has been doing, it's just a continuation of the maximum pressure policy that came into effect under Donald Trump. Before even Biden came to office, Bolton, the former national security advisor, as well as many other Trump administration officials acknowledged that the maximum pressure policy has failed. Also, the Biden administration, Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Biden himself, they have all acknowledged that this policy has failed to produce any kind of result for the United States verbally. But when it comes into action, they still continue the same kind of policy. They continue the carrot and stick. They still continue imposing sanctions on Iran. And they're not at all apparently worried about the negotiations, since we are at the final stage of the talks. And they still continue imposing further sanctions on Iran and Iranians. So what they are doing basically is continuing Donald Trump's strategy. They are not really very much willing for honoring their duties and undertakings under the JCPOA. Otherwise, it wouldn't have required us to go into negotiations. They could have easily done that as soon as Biden came to office. He could have, resumed compliance with the terms of the JCPOA last year, even without the talks, because we are talking about very specific and clear and transparent undertakings of the United States and Iran under the JCPOA, mm-hmm. but the Americans are not willing to, sure. you know, relinquish their weapon of choice. That's the sanctions. That's why the talks have been stalled.
John White, we are looking at a date here of March 27th. That's when Enrique Mora, after visiting Tehran, departed with messages. He had met with high-ranking Iranian officials, including the Iranian foreign minister. And he left with messages from Tehran to Washington. Yes. And according to what Iran is saying that we're still waiting for the answers from the other side. Mind you, that Iran did obviously make sure to, again, make it clear that the lack of the ability for the U.S. to make a political decision to remove the sanctions that are tied to economic benefits of the Iranian people is the only existing obstacle. At that point is what the Iranian foreign minister said to Enrique Mora. If that's the case, why is the U.S. not answering?
Well, thanks for having me. It's quite extraordinary that we've reached this point with regards to these negotiations in Vienna. On an objective, moral, ethical level, the U.S. should have long before now lifted the sanctions of Iran and agreed to resuscitate the JCPOA on the same terms as it was agreed initially in 2015. And Iran's foreign minister is absolutely correct when he says that Joe Biden is being held hostage by his own internal politics. His approval ratings have gone through the floor, now down to 39%. He's perceived by more and more Americans from their point of view as a weak leader. The Afghanistan debacle from their point of view in August last year, he's tried to play a strong card against Russia vis-a-vis the Ukraine conflict. That's only exacerbated the suffering of the American working class in terms of rising fuel prices and food prices. So it's quite inexplicable, if you understand this on a certain level, that the Biden administration will not acquiesce to Iran's reasonable demands. But you know what? Joe Biden has his biggest enemy is not Russia, it's not Iran, it's Donald Trump. And Trump is breathing down his shoulder. And this is where we are now with American politics. Joe Biden and the Democrats understand that Trump is likely to be re-elected in 2024 unless he plays tough with Iran vis-a-vis how Donald Trump did. And this is where the problem lies. The Iranians have nothing to apologize for. Joe Biden and his administration are being led down this path to perdition by Donald Trump and the pressure raid against him from the Republicans in the U.S. itself. It's a very sad state of affairs, but this is reality of a declining hegemonic power.
Well, I was going to ask this later, but let's get down to it, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshchesh, regarding what John White is saying there. First of all, it's one of the guarantees that Iran does want is if a new administration does come, it needs to have some kind of guarantee that it's not going to rip up the agreement. But tell us about the deal with Congress. What is that all about? Looking at one particular source, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshchesh, it says the president, Biden, will get his way because it's unlikely that Congress is going to be able to block a new agreement. And it refers back, based on this source and many other sources, actually, to when Obama actually went through and finally got its approval for the JCPOA at that point. So where does that stand?
You know, it's true that part of the problem comes from the very fact that the Biden administration is stuck with internal political disputes and rivalries and the problems that he might have domestically and especially at the Congress. But a part of the fact is this point, that this is a U.S. strategy towards Iran. It's not just the Biden administration. It's not the Donald Trump administration policy. It's the U.S. policy that came into effect under Obama, even 9 months before Obama came to office. This is the containment strategy. They do not want a conflict resolution with Iran. Let's remember that Iran and the U.S. or its European allies, they have had six cases of agreements in the past two decades. One over Afghanistan, the other one in 2003 over Iraq, three others with European states from 2003 to 2005, and the last one being the JCPOA in 2015. In all of them, according to U.S. officials and experts, Iran has been in full compliance with its undertakings because Iran has always believed in a conflict resolution approach, and it has believed, rightly or wrongly, that the deal is for conflict resolution. But the United States and its allies, they have never been in compliance with the terms of all these deals, mainly removal of sanctions, because they have never meant to go for a conflict resolution approach. What they've been doing is going for a deal in line or in the framework of containment strategy. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? It means if we have a nuclear deal and everyone sticks to the deal, then they need to contain Iran's power components with regard to its missile industry, regional power, and its laser industry, nanotechnology, aerospace program, and so on and so forth, because what they want to do is containing Iran's power. So the best weapon of choice that they got in here is the sanctions. So they always remain adamant to removing the sanctions. And now, right now, what is the problem with the talks that we don't see a deal? It's removal of sanctions on certain Iranian entities, legal and real persons. That includes actually Iranian individuals, firms, and entities that have been placed in the red list. And the U.S., which agreed a few months ago to remove them from the red list, has shown buyer's remorse. That's a known or notorious U.S. negotiating tactic. They have been doing this buyer's remorse all the time whenever they come to a deal with Iran and to the talks with Iran. Here, we are through with 97% of issues. But these the 3% left, this is very important, because if they remove this part of the sanctions from the red list of entities, firms, and individuals, then Iran would have a great more economic merits from such a deal, and they do not want it to happen because they want to keep the sanctions structure intact. They might suspend some sanctions, but they do not want Iran to enjoy the full merits of any possible deal. That's why they are adamant to doing what is right.
Right. Well, let's talk about these sanctions. That obviously they never come at a good time, but this is really at a very sensitive time, John White. And what message I'm going to ask you this sends? And particularly when we take a look also at the other angle of these sanctions, where it was basically on individuals and companies that are linked to Iran's ballistic missile program for providing assistance to Iran's ballistic missile program. I mean, they're targeting the defense of a country. You know, that's something that is Iran's red lines. So why would they go through with these sanctions?
Well, these are non-nuclear issues. These are incompatible with the original terms of the JCPOA that did not cover non-nuclear issues regarding, for example, as you just mentioned, Iran's ballistic missile program. Iran has a legitimate security interest, and they have a duty bound to their own people to uphold these security interests. This is trying to neuter Iran as a strong power in the region, and it's also a backhanded compliment, if I may say, to Iran's growing influence in the region as a pillar of stability in a region that's been mired in instability since the invasion of Iraq in 2003. But let's not be under any illusions. This is not just about US foreign policy. This is about Saudi and Israeli foreign policy. And they are having a major influence on the Biden administration's stance vis-a-vis these negotiations in Vienna. And it's a very sad state of affairs when you have a US president unsteady on his feet, cognitively challenged, who's struggling to maintain his own foreign policy. It is quite significant that his calls to the UAE and Saudi Arabia recently in the context of the Ukraine conflict to try and get them to produce more oil to stabilize energy prices globally were refused. That is quite unprecedented when you think about Washington's relationship and its influence in the Middle East. It is a waning power, and Joe Biden is a symptom of that waning power. So my suggestion to Iran, if I can say, is to stay firm, stand strong, and see this out, because the US is not the future. And I think the Iranian government and its institutions understand that. And that's why they're insisting that they will not budge from their demand that before anything can be agreed in Vienna, all sanctions must be lifted in accordance with the 2015 agreement.
Okay, let's get to one of the core issues that seems to be at hand here, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, and tell us if it is, because there are many that Iran has pointed out to. But when it comes to the IRGC, we're looking at, obviously, a red line and a key sticking point. And it doesn't make sense how this is a sticking point where it's a red line. And I'm going to put this into context and then ask you, how could this even be resolved in terms of it being on the terrorist list organization, as the U.S. has done, when the U.S. Special Envoy, Robert Malley, has said that sanctions on the IRGC would remain in place even if an agreement to restore the deal is reached?
Okay. First of all, this is not the main point that has been left. This is it is one of the very few points that have been left. The most important issue, as I just said, is removing sanctions on specific legal and real persons that includes firms, individuals, and entities in the SDN list or the so-called red list that's a part of the SDN list, that they remain adamant to removing the sanctions on these individuals and entities, because removing sanctions from these entities, individuals, and firms would enhance economic merits for Iran under any possible view. And this is very important because I'll explain about it. Removing, IRGC from the list, the IRGC has been tagged multiple times. If I'm not mistaken, under four tags, it's been sanctioned. One of them is the SDGT. If they remove this tag, there will be economic merits for Iran. But when it comes to FTO, or foreign terrorist organization, because of supporting resistant movements in the region, this is just a political tag. It doesn't include economic merits. It's just a political sanctions. It is the worst. It's the worst type of, tag or sanction on, any country or an organization or a military, an official military of a country. And by the way, the IRGC is the official military, the army of Iran, and no other military in the world has been sanctioned by the U.S. or any other country. This is something very illegal, like other U.S. sanctions on Iran and other countries and companies throughout the world. But this FTO, as I just said, is just a political tag. If they remove it, it means a very great defeat for the United States that tagged the IRGC on their FTO a couple of years ago. Actually, not couple, but in 2018, they placed it under the FTO in the FTO list. But its removal would not entail any economic merits for Iran. That's why I and some other experts insist that Iran should also continue its insistence on removing the SDGT tag as well. This is one of the other key issues. I'm not hearing about it very often in the media, but this is one more point that needs to go under discussions. And in a few more months, as the global developments are, especially with regard to the Russian confrontation with the West over Ukraine, as things are developing, especially in the energy market, soon we will see that if there is to be a deal, definitely the United States would be required to do more and to give more points and to give more merits, including removing of the SDGT from the IRGC.
John White, this administration is very keen, and Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, while running for presidency, said that we are going to enhance our relations with our neighbors, and it's doing so, and we can see the results. One of them being the major one, I'm guessing here, which is still in the works somewhat, is its relation with Saudi Arabia. Of course, we have that major development come where the Iranian Foreign Minister, Amir Abdullahian, spoke to the UN Secretary General Guterres and spoke about the JCPOA revival talks, and also the fact that there was a ceasefire between Yemen, the official government of Yemen, and Saudi Arabia, a ceasefire for 2 months at this point. Do you think then that this is something that may lead to, I guess I'm just going to say, the U.S. realizing that Iran is taking the right steps in order to regionally calm things down, because it's doing all it can diplomatically with its neighbors, yeah, or not?
Well, in the West, in the context of the conflict in Ukraine, ideology has superseded pragmatism, and that's always a bad position to be. That is the road to perdition. And I think Iran is an absolute arbiter of pragmatism over ideology. Iran is willing to forge bilateral productive relations with all its neighbours, including Saudi Arabia, despite all the enmity that has existed between those two countries for many, many years. And I think that pragmatism will always trump, no pun intended, ideology in the last analysis. I think the US has to understand, if it tries to cancel Russia and its energy supplies, it has to allow Iran's oil to be a part of the world energy market in order to stabilize global prices. Because ultimately, when people go to fill their cars up in California or New York or any part of the US, that will determine the political trajectory of that country. And the Biden administration must understand that it must acquiesce to the reality, okay, of the condition of the American people in terms of its economy. And that is a problem that Biden has.
Right.
He has been pushed by ideologues in his own administration in Washington to take these very radical steps, and it's going to be his undoing.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. But thank you for that, John White, writer and political analyst. Said Mostafa Khoshesh, also thank you for your input. Political analyst spoke to us from Tehran. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitapoy and the entire team, it's goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini strongly criticized the cinematic art of the previous regime, as it was one of the main sources of immorality in society, particularly among the young generation. He correctly believed that the dramatic arts, mainly cinema, were the tools of colonial policies of the West and anti-Islamic propaganda of the U.S. and its accomplices in the country. This week, we are going to discuss Imam Khomeini's views on political parties and groups, which were, in fact, the puppets of the big powers in Iran. Stay tuned, please.
Thank you.
During the years of struggle against the despotic Pahlavi regime in Iran, different groups resorted to various methods to topple the ruling system. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, or MKO, was one of those groups which tried to change the political system via armed struggle. The MKO was formed in 1965 with combination of two contradictory ideologies of Islam and Marxism. This organization managed to take a few terrorist acts against the regime, but in 1971, many of its leaders were identified, tortured, or executed by the intelligence apparatus of the regime, called SAVAK. In 1975, some of the MKO ringleaders, through an organizational coup, officially changed the ideology of the group led to Marxism and committed gruesome murders against their opponents thereafter. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, there emerged differences of opinion among the MKO leaders and the revolutionary leaders to the extent that, following the dismissal of President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr by the parliament, the MKO started armed activities against the Islamic Republic system and martyred a number of officials and thousands of civilians. After the Iraqi invasion of Iran in 1980, the MKO terrorist outfit transferred its base to Iraq and continued its measures against the Iranian nation. Some of the Western countries tried to put the name of the MKO in the blacklist of terrorist groups to stop its crimes against humanity. But through the pressures of influential regimes, especially the United States, they failed to pursue their demands. The terrorist outfit has been employed by Washington, Tel Aviv, and London as a tool to pursue their nefarious goals against the Iranian nation and the Islamic Republic system. The founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, writes in his testament, "My advice and recommendation to the groups, grouplets, and persons who are active against the nation, the Islamic Republic and Islam, first, in addressing their ringleaders inside and outside the country, is that the long experience of taking any measure, designing any plot, and resorting to any country and official should have taught to you, who consider yourselves as knowledgeable and wise, that the course of a selfless nation cannot be misled by resorting to terror, blast, bomb, and baseless and uncalculated lies. Never can any state and government be toppled through inhumane and illogical methods, especially a nation like Iran, whose young children to its old women and men are sacrificing their lives in the way of the goal, the Islamic Republic, the Quran, and religion. You know, and if you do not, you are thinking very naively that the nation is not with you and the army is not with you. And if you suppose that they had been with you as your friends, your bungling acts and crimes that have occurred through your provocation have separated them from you, and you have failed to do anything except forging enemies." Unquote.
Thank you.
Imam Khomeini, addressing terrorist groups, especially the MKO, writes in another part of his testament, "In the end of my life, I benevolently recommend you who have started fighting and countering this afflicted nation, which has saved itself from the oppression of criminals like the Pahlavi regime and the world devourers of the East and the West through sacrificing their best children and youth. How can the conscience of a human, no matter how wicked it is, to be content for the likely achieving of a position to behave his country and his nation in this way and does not have mercy towards their young and the elderly?" The Imam advises the ringleaders of these grouplets not to be deceived by big powers. He writes, "I advise you to give up such useless and unwise acts and not be gulled by the world devourers. And wherever you are, if you have committed crime, return to your country and the lap of Islam. Repent, as God is the most merciful of the merciful, and the Islamic Republic and the nation will, inshallah, forgive you. And if you have committed a crime that God has determined your decree, still return from halfway and return. Or if you are not brave enough, accept the punishment and hence save yourselves from God's painful punishment. Otherwise, wherever you are, do not waste your life anymore and embark on another job as it is to your benefit." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing the internal and external advocates of the MKO terrorist grouplet, writes in his testament, "Then I recommend their internal and external advocates, for what motive do you waste your youth for those whom have been proved to be serving the powerful world devourers and follow their schemes and have been fallen in their traps? In whose way are you wronging your own nation? You are the beguiled of them. And if you are in Iran, you're witnessing that the million-strong masses are loyal to the Islamic Republic and sacrifice for it. And you are witnessing that the current state and regime are wholeheartedly at the service of the destitute. And those who are spuriously feigning popularity, being mujahid and devotees of the people, have embarked on enmity against God's people and have beguiled you simple boys and girls for their purposes and the purposes of one of the world-devouring poles of power. Whereas they are either reveling in the lap of one of the criminal poles or inside the country, they are leading a luxurious life in team houses like the houses of the wretched criminals while sending you youths to death. My kind advice to you teenagers and youths inside and outside is to return from the wrong way and be united with the deprived of the society who are serving the Islamic Republic wholeheartedly. And be active for the independent and free Iran, to that the country and the nation get rid of the evil of the opponents and all continue noble life together. How long and why will you be subordinate to those who do not think except for their vested interest? You are fighting your nation in the lap of the superpowers while they have sacrificed you for their sinister purposes and seeking power."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.